morning. Today is Friday, May 19th, 2017, where I study 29 of Nehemiah. And we've gotten through chapters 1, 2, and 3. We read through chapter 3 last week, which was an account of the building of the wall. You can remember we had this map, the building of the ancient wall around Jerusalem that Nehemiah started to lead, that had been destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians about 150 years earlier. And so we're going to start in chapter 4 today. And in chapter 4, could someone get us started by reading verses 1 through 6?
Now,
it came about. Go ahead, Dave.
You're up.
No, go.
I wanted to do it because there's only six. Now, when Sanballat heard that we were building the wall, he was angry and greatly enraged, and he jeered at the Jews too. And he said in the presence of his brothers and the army of Samaria, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore it for themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish up in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and burn ones at that?" 3. Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, and he said, "Yes, what they are building, if a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall. 4. Hear, O God, for we are despised. Turn back their taunt on their own heads and give them up to be plundered in a land where they are captives. Do not cover their guilt, and let not their sin be blotted out from your sight, for they have provoked you to anger in the presence of the builders." 6. So we built the wall, and all the wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work.
Great, thanks, Dave. So, verse 1 here, you've got, you got an introduction of this guy named Sanballat, and he hears that Nehemiah has started the process of rebuilding this wall around Jerusalem. And his reaction in verse 1 is furious, anger, mocking the Jewish community in Jerusalem and Judea. And verse 2 identifies who Sanballat is. Apparently, this guy, he speaks in the presence of his brothers, the wealthy men of Samaria. So it's likely that Sanballat is some kind of ruler or leader in Samaria. And one thing that's good about reading Nehemiah and Ezra, for those of you in our Monday study, is you get to see somewhat of why the animosity exists between the Jews and the Samaritans. And by the time, and this is 400 years prior to the birth of Messiah, so the time 400 years goes by, you know, the Samaritans, as typified by Sanballat here, the relationship just gets worse and worse. Now, the interesting thing about the Samaritans, of course, is that genetically, they're kin, they're related to the Jews in Judah. Sanballat, whether he's a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob, we don't know, because not only did the Assyrians deport the aristocracy out of the 10 tribes in 722 BC when Sennacherib destroyed the capital of the northern kingdom, Samaria, but the Assyrians also emigrated or repopulated the infrastructure in the area with people groups within the Assyrian Empire. So Sanballat is likely someone who has been imported, a leader imported, a descendant of someone who has been imported, a people group by the Assyrians a few hundred years earlier. But we don't know. He could be one of the descendants of one of the 10 tribes, or he could be an admixture of them. A lot of intermarrying has been going on between the 10 tribes that were left and then these people groups that were shipped in by the Assyrians. We don't know the genetic or the biological background or the genealogical background of Sanballat. All we know is that he's a leader of the Samaritans here. And by way of background, remember that the Samaritans are really in many ways recipients of the spiritual condition of the northern kingdom. When the northern kingdom separated from Judah and Benjamin after the death of Solomon, they reconstituted worship to Yahweh, but they did it not on Mount Zion, but on Mount Gerizim in Samaria, which is modern-day Nablus, over in Israel. And so they had their own priesthood, or they used Levites, the Levitical priesthood in the 10 tribes, to conduct services around their own temple. They had a, calf, I think Jeroboam, where we learn in Kings that they worship, but nonetheless, they thought they were worshiping Yahweh, but in their own way. And this practice is probably still going on in Samaria. Sanballat finds out what's going on in Jerusalem, and his reaction in verse 1 is, again, furious, anger, mocking. And the mocking continues in verse 2. What are these feeble Jews doing? You know, what are they trying to restore for themselves? You know, are they going to... Can they offer sacrifices? This might be asking, you know, they're already offering sacrifices in the temple. What are they concerned they're not going to be able to do this anymore? Why do they need to build a wall? And then the last question in verse 2, can they revive the stones from the dusty rubble, even the burned ones? And the idea is that there's still, even though the temple's rebuilt in Jerusalem, Jerusalem is still probably filled with kind of rubble from the Babylonian destruction. In fact, if you go to Israel today, you'll see around the Temple Mount areas of stone block on the ground are from 70 AD, where the Romans just pushed off places of buildings off of the Temple Mount that they're rubble today. They're archaeological rubble that people just look at in fascination.
Just small stones.
Yeah, they're big bad dudes, yeah. So, you know, you see that same phenomenon today in Jerusalem. Verse 3. Now Tobiah the Ammonite was near. So now you have a different people group. As you read Joshua and Judges in the Exodus, you see the Ammonites were this people group that hated Israel. They didn't want them in the land. And you got their descendants now, 1,000 years later, still in the land. Tobiah is one of them. He's hanging out with Sanballat. He hears what Sanballat says. And how does Tobiah the Ammonite, in verse 3, make fun of or mock the work that Nehemiah is leading?
Well, he says if a fox should jump on it, it's going to fall.
Yeah, so these guys suck.
It's not going to be a strong wall.
Yeah, I mean, this is a joke. I mean, this wall is... Yeah, cool. Let me see. Yeah. So you can see when Jeff was in Jerusalem a couple weeks ago, there's actual kind of a picture of this phenomenon from 70 AD.
Way to go, Jeff.
There's rubble in the streets.
Yeah.
You've seen it.
Do you two have this plan today?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So this Ammonite starts to make fun of it. Verse 4. Now you have a transition. This is Nehemiah. Nehemiah is speaking from the first person, is the author of this text. And he begins, Nehemiah now prayers, "Hear, O God, we're despised. Put their reproach on their heads." And verse 5, "Don't forgive their iniquity. Let their sin be blotted out before you, because they're demoralizing us who are the builders." And you might think, well, that's not a very kind prayer. But it's very similar to how David prays in the Psalms. These are often called imprecatory prayers, prayers against your enemies. And, you know, Jesus was pretty radical when he came on the scene and he said, pray for your enemies, because they didn't have a really good example, Israel, of praying for enemies. Their example traditionally has been praying against enemies, and in the tradition of King David and Nehemiah. Verse 6, "So we built the wall. The whole wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work." So the idea here is that in verse chapter 4, the wall construction was undertaken in a complete 360-degree project in chapter 3, but they're basically starting from the foundation and building up. And by the time now it started, the word is starting to get out in the surrounding region, the project's well underway, and the wall is about half restored to its to the height that it's going to get.
Now, does it stay at half, or does it go up to the original height?
Yeah, that's a great question. Lou, could you read verses 7 through 16?
We planned that too.
Yeah.
Now when Sanballat, Tobiah, and the Arabs, and the Ammonites, and the Ashdodites heard that the repair of the walls of Jerusalem went on, and that the breaches began to be closed, they were very angry. All of them conspired together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to cause a disturbance in it. But we prayed to our God, and because of them, we set up a guard against them day and night. Thus in Judah, it was said, the strength of the burden bearers is failing, yet there is much rubbish, and we ourselves are unable to rebuild the wall. Our enemies said, they will not know or see until we come among them, kill them, and put a stop to the work. When the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times, they will come up against us from every place where you may turn. Then I stationed men in the lowest parts of the space behind the wall, the exposed places, and I stationed the people and families with their swords, spears, and bows. When I saw their fear, I rose and spoke to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people. Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. When our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had frustrated their plan, then all of us returned to the wall, each one to his work.
Okay, great. Thanks, Lou. So here you got now Sanballat again in verse 7 and Tobiah. But now you've got the Arabs. So another people group that gets mentioned. Again, these would be descendants of Ishmael. And you've got the Ashdites. Ashdod would be a city in ancient Philistine. So you've got Philistines. You've got all these people groups. Here it is, you know, a millennia after the conquest of the land by Joshua. And the people groups they had to fight against, they're still around.
Kind of like the 1940s.
Yeah. I mean, the descendants are still there, and they still have some kind of national identity. And they all are against Israel. Verse 7 even says they're very angry. I mean, what the building of the wall is ticking them off. And you know, there's nothing new under the sun. When Israel got tired of these folks blowing themselves up in the marketplace and killing everyone, they said, "Look, we've had it," and they started to build a wall that separated Jerusalem from the West Bank. And the Palestinian Authority went nuts. So did all the Arab countries, went nuts. This is apartheid. Petitioned the United Nations. This is an apartheid wall. So really, this is very, just, again, nothing new under the sun. It's the same thing going on and on, over and over again. Why would you be angry? Because they're building a defensive wall. Who knows, but they are. Verse 8. Verse 8 tells us all of them. Again, we've talked about this in our Monday study. The one thing that Gentiles have in common throughout history, the one thing that can gather and inspire and motivate Gentiles to overcome all division, racial division, is...
They all hated the Jews.
Hatred of Jews. Hatred of Israel and hatred of Jews can bring Gentiles together and overcome all racial divisions like nothing else has ever been able to do in the history of civilization.
Yep.
And it's so here. It is so here. This hatred, this desire to destroy the elect, the spiritual influences motivated by Hasatan, just bring these people groups together to conspire, verse 8, to fight against Jerusalem. They actually want to go to war now and begin the process of death and destruction
again
for people that are building a wall on Mount Zion. And verse 9, but Nehemiah says, we prayed to our God because of them. And also, too, they can't devote, check out verse 9 here, they can't devote 100% of their resources now to the building of the wall in verse 9. Why is that?
Century.
They need, now they got to divide labor. Now they've got to reduce the resources meant to repair the wall and rebuild the wall to protect and defend this gathering threat. Verse 10 goes on. Thus in Judah it was said, so now Nehemiah is giving us kind of the Gallup poll. He's giving us the poll results from the overnight polling. The strength of the burden bearers is failing, yet there is much rubbish, and we ourselves are unable to rebuild the wall. Apparently, Nehemiah has been really cracking the whip, not as a slave driver, but as someone, look, we got to get this done. We got to put all everything into it. And they've been working hard, and now it seems like they're finding out, not only have we been busting our ass and putting everything into this, but now we got to worry. They're probably ticked at Nehemiah too. We didn't have to worry about people trying to kill us before you got here in Nehemiah. We didn't have to worry. We were doing a lot less work. We were having a lot more free time. We could play Nintendo. We could watch what we wanted on the internet. And we didn't have to do a lot of work. And now we got to worry about people hurting us too? This blows. So you got in verse 11. And we know we can hear our enemies. And we know what they're saying, verse 11. Here's what they're saying. They will not know or see until we come among them, kill them, and put a stop to their work. In other words, they are hearing the rumblings of these people groups that their goal is to ambush the work and kill everyone working on this wall. It's a really bad terrorism. Mm-hmm. It's ancient terrorism. Place fear in the hearts of those that are doing what the Lord's calling them to do. Verse 12, when the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times, the idea here is that you've got the population of Jews outside of Jerusalem that are coming in daily to do the work, and it's like the spies that went out into the land that came back with the bad report over and over and over again. We're doomed. We're dead. We're going down. The whole world's gathering against us. We don't have a very good plan here to survive this. They say in verse 12, they are going to come up against us from every place where you turn. So verse 13, here's Nehemiah. Now, again, a great leadership example, because Nehemiah doesn't respond to the fear. And it's got to be hard to do. Because fear is contagious. It's very, very contagious.
Especially on the leader.
Yeah, and there's probably a lot of rumblings about Nehemiah just speculating. You know, life was good before this guy got here. Why are we having to deal with this now? So verse 13, so Nehemiah, then I stationed men in the lowest parts of the space behind the wall, the exposed places, and I stationed the people and families with their swords and spears and bows. So you've got Nehemiah now really reacting to the threats, not realizing a lot of it is just propaganda, but also taking seriously that this is probably real reconnaissance. There's
prepper.
He's
a prepper.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. And he's getting everyone ready for a possible ambush. Verse 14, Nehemiah says, when I saw their fear rampant, just infecting the entire community, I rose and spoke to the nobles, the leaders. Now he's speaking to the leaders of the community, the officials, and the rest of the people. And in verse 14, what is in response to the fear, the abject fear and panic, what is Nehemiah's message in verse 14?
Don't be afraid.
Yeah, why?
Because we have the Lord.
Yeah, yeah. Don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. So not to burden our good study with homily, but let me give you just a personal example. As I was reading this, I was thinking about this lawsuit. And that I had to go through. And, one of the goals of the enemy, sometimes we do live in a bubble, and sometimes I get in places where I feel like I'm living in a bubble. But if you're doing his work, which Nehemiah was doing, then the enemy is going to be threatened by that. The enemy doesn't want us doing his work. And so one of the greatest weapons that the enemy has is psychological intimidation. you know, if you've ever been a young person intimidated by a bully, or even an older person, an adult intimidated by someone who has a lot of power to destroy you, that can invoke a lot of panic and a lot of fear. And so the enemy is wants to intimidate, place abject fear into the very hearts of the work of the Lord. And the thing that sucks about doing the work of the Lord sometimes is that, you know what? Life is much easier if you're not doing His work. There's a whole lot easier path to walk than the path of obedience sometimes. And some of us would probably argue with that, and I would disagree. But in many ways, the walk of disobedience is very tempting, because it's a very easy walk, especially when you look around you and you say, man, these jokers don't have to put up with this stuff.
I would just say it appears to be easier.
Good point. So you've got, you know, all these guys doing this work, and now they've got the threat, real threat of, we could get killed for doing this, for doing extra work. And, you know, when I left, you know, my old business with just absolute stress, you know, losing my best friend of 40 years and just everything crumbling and just not knowing what was going to be happening in the business and what was going to happen one day to the next. And having to come out of that hole, I was grateful, you know, to go through the fire and realize, okay, we made it. But then to have the other stress of the Obama administration threatening to sue me, it was just like, it was intimidating. It was like, this is real. And then when they filed a lawsuit and started to set their lawyers against me, I just thought, I'm dead. This could just destroy me. It could all be over. And it was very, very hard to really get into a position of, okay, I'm scared because I got to feed my family, I got to raise my family, and this is what I'm called to do. And now I've got the power, the force and power of the Democratic Party and the Obama administration and all their resources against me. And so there was a lot of fear. But I had to really consider, you know, verse 14. That's right. And I had to really think, okay, Lord, this is scary. And I feel like wetting my pants. But where are you in this? And I really had to get hold of His instruction to me. Don't be afraid of them. You know, don't be afraid of George Lucas or Valerie Jarrett or Barack Obama. Why should I be afraid of them, Lord? Because I am the God of Israel, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And 40 million Arab nations, people came up against me 50 years ago, the month you were born, to destroy you. And you survived. So, even though I was afraid, I wasn't going to roll. I wasn't going to roll. And that doesn't mean the fear didn't go away. The fear remained. But I knew I was serving that same God who's delivered His people for millennia. And so I say that to say this. The enemy is still roaming the earth with fangs and a roar like a lion, seeking us whom he may devour. He wants to eat us alive. And the more we're purposed, again, forgive me for the homily, but here it is. The more we're purposed to do what He's calling us to do, there's going to be plenty of obstacles. There's going to be a lot of obstacles. It's not going to be easy. And it's also going to be a new level of intimidation by the enemy. The enemy getting in your face, literally just breathing in your face, smelling His breath. And feeling that intensity of, I want you to devour you so that you no longer have any more existence in this world. And that's, I think, what these guys were facing. And Nehemiah wasn't falling for it. Nehemiah wasn't caving. I mean, the easy answer would have been, let's just stop building. Let's appease these people. Look, if we don't represent a threat to them, if we don't provoke them, then things will die down. You know, we can kind of grow our grapes, drink our wine, and everything will be fun. But he just said, don't be afraid. Remember who we serve. And not only that, fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, your houses. It's not all about you. There's something bigger than just you, Nehemiah's telling these guys. It's the people you're have been placed in some kind of shepherding role over too. Think about them. We're doing this for their good. And you got to protect them. You can't just fold when the enemy wants to intimidate you. Because you're the line of defense between the people you're shepherding, mainly your family.
Chris,
please.
I have a question. You said something earlier. You said that Old Testament, New Testament, today, all Gentiles hated the Jews. Let me finish.
Yeah, go.
And I agree with that, because I know how I grew up with my father. My father hated the Jews. I don't know why, but he hated the Jews. Nowhere in the Bible does it say, at least I don't think, that there's a reason for it. I know when I was a kid growing up in the city, I was very jealous of rich kids because they had a lot of things I didn't have, and I saw it. So I hated them because they had stuff that I didn't have. I'm trying to get this in my brain. Is it because all these people over all these years, from the old to the new to today, is it because they feel or they're jealous that we have something that they don't have? We have peace, we have God, we have Jesus. Can't grab it, but it's in here. Is it because of that reason why these people hated the Jews so much? Because the Jews did, most of the time, stay steadfast to God, and then under the New Testament into Jesus? Is that... I'm trying to find out why everyone hates the Jews.
Well, what do you think?
I think they're jealous of the Jews, because I think the Jews have something from way, way, way back to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that they had something that nobody else had, and that is a faith to something that nobody could see.
I think you're onto something. Lou, because check out Romans chapter 11.
Romans. Okay, what verse?
Let me just get oriented here. Somebody help me find the verse in Romans. It's either 9, 10, or 11 on provoking Israel to jealousy.
I hear Levi saying it somewhere.
it's Paul speaks. I just
because of transgression, salvation has come to the Gentiles Israel envious.
Oh, yeah. Where are you at there?
That's 11:11.
11:11. Okay, thank you. So I think you're onto something, Lou, and here's why. Good. Thank you, Paul. Thank you. Okay, now we're in Romans 11, and check out verse 11. And so, in all of Romans, Paul is basically saying to believers, Gentile believers in Rome for the most part, you are his. And in verse 8, he says, nothing can separate you from his love. Not angels, not life, not death, not height, not... And so... the obvious question in response to Paul is, wait a second, what do you mean God can never reject me? He's rejected Israel, hasn't he? Because if he has rejected Israel, then you might be rejected too.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where Paul answers that question. He is very adamant in 9, 10, 11. He has not rejected Israel. God forbid, he says. But he does tell us why Israel has rejected him. And he does tell us why Gentiles are now allowed to be part of the family, believing Gentiles.
That made the Jews jealous.
So hold on, this is exactly where I'm going. Verse 11, after he explains, you know, how is it that these covenants that are eternal and unconditional with Israel, how is it that they rejected this God? God's got to be done with them. And so here's what Paul says in verse 11. I say then, they did not stumble so as to fall, did they? What Paul's saying in that sentence is that their action of rejecting their Messiah, when I say they, I'm talking about the leadership, because not all of Israel rejected Messiah. Okay, it's kind of what you said at the beginning, Lou. Why do all Gentiles hate Jews? I understand what you're saying. Not every single Gentile hates Jews. Right. A lot of Gentiles don't, but for the most part, all of them do.
Yeah.
And so Paul is saying that their rejection of Messiah here is a stumble, but is it a fall? In other words, is it a total separation? And he answers his question.
May it never be.
But he does give us the explanation as to what's going on. Why did this happen? And he says, but by their transgression, and this is Israel's transgression of rejecting her promised Messiah, that's what they did. That's the transgression that Paul is addressing here. And Paul's saying, but because of that, wealth, great riches has come now to the Gentiles because of his atoning work. Now, any Gentile that calls on the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob gets into the party without circumcision, without keeping kashrut, without any of the law. That's a big deal. But Paul goes on to say this. The purpose of bringing... Here's the reason God wants to bring Gentiles into the fold. What is it in verse 11?
To make the Jews jealous.
That's exactly
right. Because
the
Jews had it all the time. They thought it was just for them.
So you're on to something. People are envious generally. And I think you're right. People probably do hate Israel because they're so exceptional. And sometimes I think as Gentiles, we forget our purpose. Our purpose is to make Israel envious, because we actually have a closer relationship with their God than they do. The ones among the nation who do not know the Messiah.
That's right.
Now, you can't provoke someone to jealousy. I can't make Tim jealous of what I have if I want to kill Tim, or if I call for Tim's total destruction, or I call Tim a dirty, filthy Neapolitan. Tim's not going to be jealous of me. He's going to be pissed at me. Mm-hmm. I can make Tim jealous by serving Tim, maybe, showing complete peace, offering to pray. And Tim doesn't know that. What's this dude have that I'm lacking? And so, coming back to answer your question, Lou, I think you're onto something. Now, the other question, why did Gentiles still want to destroy Israel? Long answer, but we got time. So Arnold Fruchtenbaum, the guy that I really follow a lot in terms of a lot of our studies, used to give a public speech at churches and at universities, colleges, called How to Destroy the Jews.
What?
Yeah.
Really?
How to Destroy the Jews. Oh, yeah. Man. And the idea was to provoke controversy, to get people to show up. So he was scheduled to speak for, I think it was Texas A&M, and Campus Crusade and all the university Christian organizations put out the word, hey, we're going to have a big assembly here to gather to find out how to destroy the Jews. And it provoked a lot of fervor and so, and their desire was to get Jewish people to show up.
But no protest.
Yeah, well, I think this was maybe 20 years ago, probably before, the modern closed-down free speech movement. But here's what the whole lecture was about.
It wasn't in Berkeley.
Yeah. Let's go to Jeremiah chapter 31.
What verse?
So, in Jeremiah 31... And remember, the thing that's interesting about Jeremiah 31 is once you get there is, you know, you got verses 1 through 9, which are a revelation to the nation of Israel of the coming new covenant. So Jeremiah is saying, here, Yahweh wants to share with you this new covenant. That's verses 1 through 9. But then now you have in verse 10. So the presentation on how to destroy the Jews was Fruchtenbaum speaking about these verses, starting at verse 10. Hear the word of the Lord, O nations, Gentiles, and declare to the coastlands afar off, and say, he who scattered Israel will gather him and keep him as his shepherd keeps his flock. Verse 11. For the Lord has ransomed Jacob and redeemed him from the hand of him who is stronger than he. Verse 12. They shall come and shout for joy on the height of Zion, and they shall be radiant over the bounty of the Lord. Am I in the right place? I'm sorry. No, I'm not. Forgive me. I'm reading the wrong place. What I meant to say is verses 27 through 34 for the new covenant.
Oh, okay.
My bad. Scratch that. Rewind for purposes of the recording. Beginning of chapter 27 through 34, the God of Israel discloses to the nation, look, there's a new covenant on its way, and it's going to change over that old covenant that I made with you in Sinai. Verse 35 is where Fruchtenbaum's teaching on the very important topic that gathered a lot of people, how to destroy the Jews. And so he said, here's how you destroy the Jews. Verse 35, thus says the Lord, who gives the sun for light by day and fixed order of the moon and the stars for light by night, who stirs up the sea so that it waves roar, the Lord of hosts is his name. Verse 36, if this fixed order departs from before me, declares the Lord, then the offspring of Israel shall cease from being a nation before me forever. Okay? So verse 37, thus says the Lord, if the heavens above can be measured and the foundations of the earth searched out below, then I will cast off all the offspring of Israel for all that they have done, declares the Lord. So on those two verses, the lecture was built. Here's how to destroy the Jews. If you can build an atomic nuclear weapon large enough to send it into the sun and blow it to smithereens, build a large enough atomic bomb to send it into the moon and blow it to smithereens. And then after that, if you can build another nuclear device to go into the center of the earth and blow the earth to smithereens, then you can destroy Israel.
So it's totally impossible.
So the idea here God's telling us is it possible to destroy the Jews? No. So I'm actually going to answer your question about why people hate the Jews at the end, why they still want to kill them. So the funny part of the story is that apparently a lot of Jewish people didn't show up to this. It was mostly believers. They had about 50 people.
Oh.
But a number of Arabs showed up.
Imagine that.
And Fruchtenbaum tells a story that after the lecture, kind of everyone understood, you know, the whole point. He said two of these Arab guys came up to him at the end of the lecture and were just really intent, you know, strong accent. There's got to be an easier way.
Really? Oh my gosh. Got to be an easier way. That is great.
So, I believe that the earth still wants to eliminate Israel from the surface, just like any body wants to eliminate anything foreign. It wants to just reject it and destroy it because this tells us that there's a king coming. And when he comes, the folks running the show now are going to come under alignment. And this king is coming for a specific people group, Israel. So the idea is if you get rid of them, maybe you get rid of the reason for this king to come back.
It's kind of interesting, kind of looking back and watch the Star Wars films. Lucas has created a Death Star.
Well, that's a good point.
I think, Chris, that is really it. I really think it's like the Earth is kind of like this giant chess game between El Satan, as you would say, and Jesus, Satan, and the Holy Spirit. And, you know, just like Satan had all the firstborn, all the males of Hebrew children killed under Pharaoh's time, I think it's kind of the same idea a little bit. He's trying to still win. He thinks he can outsmart the Almighty.
Not only Pharaoh, but Herod tried to kill Jesus in Bethlehem when he found out he was born there.
So I think it's really, I don't think it has anything to do with us on earth. I think it's what's going on.
It's definitely
here.
Spiritual. There's no explanation.
And also, like, if you did me wrong and I hate you and you have a cousin or a son, I'm going to automatically, if I really hate you, not like them, just by association. And so I think these are God's chosen people. Okay, well, I hate them then. I'm just going to take them.
And also, too, the amount of energy spent in trying to destroy them and kill them and eliminate them. There's, you can't, and the duration of time that's been going on, there's no, you can't logically explain it. It's spiritual. It's fully spiritual.
And then one last thing, as far as the dark, frightened, scary time you mentioned, like with you and about the study, I will say, for me, and I, as I look around the room, I think all of us have been in that spot, is at those times when I have nothing else and it looks like I'm going to go down, or I'm in trouble, I feel more alive than I do any other time. Is that true for you? As far as...
If I answer yes, God, I'm afraid. Because I don't want to go back there, but I might
but,
will.
But I feel... The other thing is, I have clarity of thought. I remember Ernie Puckett, when he was dying of cancer, said, you know, I don't wonder about things. It's either yes or no. I know what I'm thinking. And also, the purpose and what is right is clear when I'm in a bad situation. Was that true?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And so there is a good component to these dark times that we avoid with all of our passion. And I also think that it's at these times, the guy in the video even mentioned this a little, we have insight and a revelation of mission that we just don't get when we're going through our normal routine and we're too busy to stop and think and evaluate what we're really going to do, our relationship.
Chris, I have one last question real quick. In verse, when I was reading this on my own, in verse 34, the last sentence that says, "For I will forgive their iniquity and their sin, I will remember no more." God, is this where God is saying, I'm going to forgive Israel of their sin, and I will remember no more? So, is that when he brought Israel into the new covenant?
No.
Let's hold that answer. You can answer after we pray. Okay, yeah. Some people have to go.